everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, China's communist capitalist march towards an ecological apocalypse and Chinese-U.S. tensions. Dr. Richard Smith is my guest. He is a historian specializing in China and its tradition to understanding how its economy works, but not always understanding the consequences for having that economy. It is now in a position of transitioning to capitalism, and we'll talk about that. Dr. Richard Smith also has a background in environmental issues and ecological studies. He received his doctorate in history from UCLA. He's written on many penetrating investigative reports and research papers on capitalism's failures and threats to the preservation of our planet. He is the author of Green Capitalism, The God That Failed, published earlier this year by World Economic Association. And he is currently working on two additional books involving China issues. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks, Gary. Nice to be here.
Before we look at China's environmental record and its position today as the world's largest polluter and emitter of greenhouse gases, and how it is China is supposedly threatening the future of the planet, I'd like you to speak about China's transition to capitalism. And during my earlier broadcast, you spoke about the free market as a driving engine leading humanity towards self-destruction. And unless the free market is dismantled and the domestic and global economy transitions to a new economy, there's very little hope for civilization as we know it. Before China embraced capitalism, it remains largely a global backwater, although a very powerful and aggressive backwater. There was nothing in pre-capitalist China that can compare to the modernization and economic growth being seen today. So clearly capitalism in some ways can be said to have catapulted China into a new role as the world's leading economic power. Yet it's not capitalism as we experience practice capitalism in Europe, United States, and other countries aligned to strict free market models. So in what ways is China's capitalism very different from what we are seeing elsewhere? And also, of the long-term impacts those differences make in China's standing in the world and its influence on the global economy. The forum is yours.
Thanks. Okay, that's a very good question. How is China's capitalism different from capitalism elsewhere? Well, you're right that you're certainly right that before the turn to market reforms in the 1980s, China was a kind of typical stagnant, backward, Stalinist economy. And the market reforms have certainly completely transformed China's economy, but not completely, because what's different about China's capitalism from the rest of the world is that they brought in market incentives and market opportunities and market pressures and so forth, and brought in foreign investors and lots of capital to develop China's industries and create whole new industrial sectors and so forth. But they kept the basic structure of political and economic power in China. That is, they kept, there was no private property in China. They kept state power, state ownership of all the land in China and most of the industry. Deng Xiaoping's plan was not to transition to capitalism in China, but to use capitalism to renovate the Stalinist economy. And that's pretty much what he has done, what they did. They've been pretty successful at that in their terms. That is, they brought in foreign investors. They set up little special economic zones in Shenzhen, Shanghai, and the coastal economies, to produce mostly for export, and that took off. China's exports were just completely transformed the world economy, and out of that, they accumulated huge foreign exchange reserves. China has something close to $4 trillion in foreign exchange at the moment. So the foreign exchange has helped and given them the money to renovate the big state industrial sector. But the state economy still dominates China. The state, all the commanding heights of China's industry, mining, metallurgy, most manufacturing, communications, banking, rails, shipping, trains, that's all state-owned or almost all state-owned. I go through in this paper we're talking about here, I published in the review of Real World Economics Review last month in the end of May, actually, it came out. I gave a breakdown of the
Richard, that's not really significant. What is significant is giving us your insights, your deep insights, into at what cost to the world, to people living on the West Coast of the United States and California, where a major source of their air pollution, their particulate matter that's lodging in their lungs, is coming from fire-burning coal plants in China. And then you have to associate each part of this puzzle with the next. For example, when you look at China's economy and its economic growth and the opportunity to do business with it, well, you have to say, all right, they can produce a lot of products, but are these quality products? They have a lot of labor, one of the largest labor forces in the world. How they treat their labor? Do they treat them decently? Do they give them a living wage? Do they provide them with incentives? Or do they exploit them? What does this mean when China takes on the job of manufacturing a sewing machine or a dishwasher or an automobile if that at one time had been the exclusive domain to American workers, American manufacturing? Because when I'm driving around the United States in the last 5 years doing a documentary called Poverty Inc., I'm seeing communities that at one time were thriving, like Camden, New Jersey. RCA Victor was there, and Campbell Soup was there, and it was the shipbuilding capital of the world was in Camden, New Jersey. They had zero unemployment. They had a thriving middle class, a working middle class. They did not have a crime problem. Now it is the most crime-ridden, dangerous city and poverty-stricken city in the United States. And I walked up and down those mean streets with my camera interviewing people about what happened. And the one thing everyone said was they took the jobs from here and they took them to China or elsewhere. So we've lost 30 million jobs to other countries, a lot of them to Canada, but also Bangladesh. And our garment industry went to Bangladesh because American woman is not going to work for 14 cents an hour. All right, they're going to have unions that protect them, that give them safe work environment, that don't overstress them, they get overtime. If they work overtime in Bangladesh, you can work 18 hours a day. So Mexico with NAFTA was thriving for corporations, but then China came along and said, hold on, we can build everything you're building in Mexico cheaper in China. We'll even give you inducements. We'll give you free factories. What do you mean? Well, it would cost you $50 million to build a factory to manufacture your appliances. We'll build it for you. And we won't charge you taxes. And then, gee whiz, to build that same, let's say, washing machine in the United States would cost $60. But then to build it in Mexico was $40. To build it in China was $20. So suddenly China became the manufacturing capital of the world. But at what cost? 54,000 factories have closed in the United States in the last 14 years. 54 to 58,000, depending upon the figures. That's a lot of people. You never hear this discussed. It's not on any of the investment shows. It's not in anyone's speeches. It's like it doesn't exist. The complete emasculation and evisceration of the American workforce to where we're only providing service jobs now, and even other countries like India is taking that over. So that's also part of this puzzle in China. So they're outdoing everyone else. They have capital, they have education, and they can print their own currency. We don't know how much gold they actually have. But we also know that a lot of the things made in the United States comes from China. That we get too uppity with China, there's going to be a blowback because every computer, every cell phone, every electronic device, most of the equipment used in our jets, our satellites, our military-industrial products, all have components made in China because they control 90% of the world's precious minerals. So that's a piece of this puzzle also. So the investors, the economists are saying great, great, great. And then you have to look at the victims, nature, the rivers, the people in China and elsewhere. That's the story I'd like for you to tell us now, please.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what happened. I mean, with the Chinese, the Communist Party set up basically a police state capitalism in China in the 1980s, 90s. They barred labor unions. Activists were routinely hauled off to prison. They suppressed wages so that they could create the global bottom floor for light industrial production, the lowest cost light industrial production for in great numbers, masses of people. So this had the advent in the 1980s and 90s of huge pool of industrial workers, super cheap, ultra cheap industrial workers, acted as a magnet to draw industry there. And secondly, the lack of environmental restrictions. So the industries were pretty much free to do what they wanted in the 80s and 90s. So these were huge magnets to bring industry to China, which closed down. The industries closed down here. They went to Mexico, then they went to China, as you said. And for a couple of decades, 2.5 decades, this has been the basis of China's growth. Of course, at a huge cost, social cost for the Chinese, and environmental cost, because in the end there is there's no free lunch here. In the end, these the costs of production were just off-shouldered onto the environment and to workers and peasants in China, and the consequences are quite horrific. But this is set up. They set up a kind of society, this kind of police state capitalism that's radically different than anywhere else in the rest of the world, and that's in part because the nature of the ruling class of the Chinese party bureaucracy is such that the top doesn't, for all the kind of dictatorship and this quasi-totalitarian arrangement they have there, for all of that, the top can't really control the locals very effectively, because the locals, what you have is a collective ruling class. The entire Communist Party owns the economy collectively. They don't own it privately. No cadres own shares in state businesses. They're all owned by the state. But that means that these locals have some power. They have the ability to resist efforts by the center to, say, clean up their industries or stop building local coal-fired power plants. If these local guys can build more plants and build more factories and build more plants and coal-fired power plants and push more commodities onto the world market, they do so, and the center can't really stop them. So you have a kind of lawless situation in which it's very difficult for the state to rein in pollution, even when they try to. But in the end, the state can't really rein in pollution so much anyway, because the state itself is conflicted about pollution, because the state, since they made this transition to this kind of hybrid bureaucratic collectivist capitalism, they have a big problem. They have to generate constant employment, because anywhere from 12 to 15 million new workers come on the market every year in China. And it used to be higher. It was 20, 22 million in the 70s. So the problem is, in the old days, under Mao, in the old system, they just assigned, as children grew up and became workers, they just assigned them to local factories, often the same production units their parents were in. But since they turned to the market, the state has not been guaranteeing everybody employment. And so people had to go out into the free market. And so in China, you had this kind of free market economy within the state economy, kind of an economy within the economy for the last 2.5 decades or so. But the problem is that as more and more people come onto the market, if they can't get jobs, and especially in recent years as the economy has declined since the last like 3 years or so, especially since the crisis, the state has had to create massive public works programs to create people, to create jobs for people. You know, in capitalism, it's not in the West, in the U.S., for example, it's not the government's fault. It's not the government's responsibility if there's lots of unemployment. People have to fend for themselves and go out and get a job. It's a private economy. It's not even the responsibility of particular corporations to provide it. It's only in typical, in situations of real dire crisis, like the Great Depression or something, that the government creates a public work program. But in China, the government can't afford that because there is so much anger, so much resentment, and so much distrust of the government out there in society that the government has to create employment. They have to generate jobs. And so that's why you see this incredibly wasteful overproduction of building endless apartment blocks that are empty, whole ghost cities, building more high-speed trains that they don't need, more subways they don't need, more highways, creating an auto industry they really don't need, and just overproducing everything and overconsuming resources to do that. I mean, by overconsuming, I mean far out of proportion to the Chinese population in the on the planet. They're consuming resources to produce enormous amounts of stuff. Now, some of this, about 20% of the Chinese economy, is geared to producing stuff that, you know, they ship overseas, they export, we used to produce. But the rest of it is just going to, is as I sort of try to show in my paper, pretty much squandered on unnecessary, useless production in China itself, the overbuilding of cities and highways and infrastructure and dams and so on and so forth. But they have to do this, given the contradictions of the system, they have to do this to keep employment up. They're really fearful of this. So that is a major, major driver to overproduction in a way that's not the case in capitalism in the rest of the world.
Here is a difference. I appreciate that insight. Thank you, Richard. There's a big difference between the United States and Russia and some other countries. In the United States, we currently have more than 65 million Americans who would like full-time employment, to be gainfully employed, to have a quality of life at the end of the week. We don't have jobs for these people. The jobs have been outsourced. Also, the people who are working frequently at jobs that historically they would never have accepted because they weren't in the area of their education and they pay too little. So you see very frequently people who are retired now working bagging groceries in supermarkets, working in fast food outlets or in box stores like Walmart for very little money. After they take out their taxes, the people are left with less than a minimum wage. Now, if you have increasing rent and there's a glut of homes in the United States, there's over 4 million empty homes, and yet the smart guys on Wall Street bought up all those foreclosed homes for pennies on the dollar and then jacked up the rents tremendously. So now if you want to rent a house, you have to pay a lot of money, far more than what you historically would have, and you have to have the money in order to pay that rent. And they don't care if you can afford it or not. New York City, for example, I went to look at an apartment for one of my employees who said, "I don't know the value of an apartment. My parents are going to have to help me with paying the rent, and I don't want to get stuck in a bad situation. Would you at least come since you know Manhattan?" I said, "Sure." Well, after looking all over the Upper West Side, the best deal that this person could find was a 600-square-foot apartment that had no indoor bathroom for $1,400 a month. And I said, "You know, this is really no bigger than a walk-in closet." Now, coming from a 2,000-square-foot apartment that I had for 20 years at a very low rent until I bought it, I'm amazed at what they're getting for things today. But that's the market. So now, in the United States, when you have massive unemployment, don't for a moment think that the 5.3 or 5.4% we're told are unemployed, that does not account for people who are working small jobs at few hours or who have stopped looking altogether. They're all excluded. So if you can't find work, you're no longer considered unemployed. You simply don't exist as a statistic. And the same is true for those who are working only part-time or seasonal work during a holiday, Thanksgiving, Christmas, etc. So in America, we just stay home and we are angry and we compensate by overeating, watching stupid reality television, and getting drunk or getting high. That's how many people. But you never see, never will you see a national protest against the corporate interest for getting people to work, to, in effect, open small businesses, to giving them zero interest loans like we give the big banks. In China, however, they had over 10,000 major protests last year alone, with millions of people participating collectively. You didn't hear a word about that in the American media. Not a word. So when they get angry in China, they go to the streets. They shut down industries. They raise hell. In the United States, we take a Valium. Big difference. So I can understand why the Chinese leadership wants to spend money, even though it can't afford it, on creating these phantom jobs, phantom cities. But tell us about those cities, because no one knew what was going on for a long time. All we knew that there were these huge cities, and some of these cities were so large that they could accommodate millions of people. And now the question is, why didn't anyone live there? And it wasn't like there was one city. At one point, I was told that there were upwards of 67 such cities, large and small, but I wasn't told why they were built, and that collectively they could all hold about 70 million people if it was ever needed. So why would they build these cities? What kind of quality building was it? Was it just junk building that didn't have a proper infrastructure? Where was their water supply? In one city, I was told they didn't have a water filtration system. So give us the lowdown on the phantom cities of China.
Well, I can't say I'm an expert on the phantom cities of China, the ghost cities of China, but there certainly are a lot of them. They're mostly concentrated in the, like, what they call the second and third tier cities, not so much Beijing. But what happened in the 1980s and 90s was that the government is promoting market reforms, and so one of the ways they tried to do that was to make local governments responsible for their own finances, and so they cut off central allocations of finances for cities to a great extent, and that gave the cities no way to pay for their that left the cities with no way to pay for their schools and police and so social services and so forth. So what they began to do was to sell off land to developers around the city. And so the cities gradually expanded all over the place, and they would sell off land, and developers would build apartment blocks on them, and so on. And the local governments would borrow money from the central government for this project. That would be okay. The central government would give them money to do that because these are constructed projects for them. They're keeping people busy in expansion. So what happened in the 90s, especially in the 90s and 2000s, you had just a takeoff over many, many areas. I mean, big cities like this Ordos out in the middle of the desert or Zhengzhou, ghost city in Henan, huge cities. And these are built for more than a million people. You know, these are not shabby constructions. I mean, they're often very nice constructions, but they have hardly any people. They have huge miles of apartments, but not just that. They have hospitals and schools and universities and theaters and museums and recreational facilities. But you look at the photographs. It's just there's hardly any people there. So this took off in the 80s and 90s. The construction industry is easily close to 25-30% of the economy. So it's become a huge portion of a huge way for the government to generate GDP growth and keep people employed, and the local governments just borrow money from the central government, which is flush with cash from exports, and so it keeps on going. There's much talk in the West about, well, all these governments are so indebted, and it's true they're indebted, but it's not quite the same thing, because they borrow money from the central government and they pay it back to the central government, or don't. They don't have to pay the loans back. The loans are forgiven because these are not real banks. This is one going from one pocket to the other. This is not like borrowing from J.P. Morgan or Citibank or something. They don't have to pay these loans back. And so it gave these local governments tremendous incentive to borrow and spend money on building everywhere across the country, not just apartment blocks and cities, but infrastructure. I cited the case of the high-speed rail, overbuilding of high-speed rails and local airports. I mean, there are airports built out in the middle of nowhere. There are no cities, and local officials try to attract interest in their local city if they put an airport there, if they put a rail station there, if they put a freeway there. So they spent enormous sums on infrastructure construction over the last decades, and I included some photos in my paper of lots of cities and palatial accommodations for local cadres and offices and so forth. And so that was basically the logic. Basically, you can borrow and keep spending. It's not like here. You know, like here, you might have a developer out in New Jersey who will borrow some money from the local bank and go build a little housing estate there of a few dozen houses or something. They can get money and do that. But what developer is going to build a whole city or a huge railway system or bridges and highways, and what bank would give them the money to do so here without plausible customers at the end of the day? But in China, they don't need plausible customers, because they can always just fall back on the government, who will give them more money, and the spending machine keeps going on, and so the building keeps going.
Okay, that's one part of this equation. But Richard, what about China as the world's largest global polluter and contributor to climate change and global warming? We tend to view the United States more in this role, and largely because of our manipulation of corporate-friendly policies that enable greenhouse emissions and resource exploitation to continue. But when we look carefully at the environmental conditions in China and the statistics showing the levels of air pollution, toxic contamination, and destruction of its environment and ecology, I think it is accurate to say that China is leading the way towards global ecocide and environmental apocalypse. And increasingly, China is becoming a net importer for many resources that earlier it was a net exporter. It consumes over 30% of many of the world's essential resources, and such as minerals and industrial metals and fossil fuels and biomass, and now it is continuing its gluttonous resource agenda by devastating other countries' environments, such as the African nations, Malaysia, Indonesia, and South America. They come in with deep pockets. After all, if you're a poor or impoverished nation and people show up saying, we're not, unlike America, we're not going to bring in military bases and dominate you that way. We're going to be friendly. We're going to build schools and hospitals and clinics, and we're going to build you housing. In return, we're also going to give you lots of employment. We're going to bring our own people in, but we'll employ some of you. And we're going to handle a lot of your infrastructures. Like, you don't have a good water system, we'll build a good water system for you. So the Chinese learned some lessons we did not, and they've ingratiated themselves to nations. They have given them money and infrastructure because they're masters at this. But in return, that country may have to give over its bauxite, or its ore, or its silver, or gold, whatever it is, or maybe millions of acres turned over to genetically engineered soy to grow the soy to feed to its pigs and cows. So in the end, China has too many people, a too great a demand, a too high of quality of life, mocking or mimicking the American standard of living to keep those people at bay. They have to supply this. So they're exploiting nations all over the world. Talk about that side of this, please.
Well, it goes without saying that the Chinese have the right, like everyone else in the third world, to develop and have a decent standard of living, a material standard of living provides a satisfactory education and living conditions and food and housing and so on and so forth. But the problem is they're trying to do that by mimicking the West, that is, in creating a consumerism economy, a consumer economy. And this, however, is, you're talking about a population of 1.4 billion, like four or five times the size of the U.S., not to mention Europe and so forth. So we live on one planet with limited resources. And up to the advent of China's rise, it was mostly in the United States that was a major consumer of world resources. But since China's has taken off, and because China's own resources were very limited, they've had to reach out to the rest of the world, as you say, to Malaysia, Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America, to get the resources to keep this engine of wasteful consumerism growing. And so that's the overall problem. And the consequence is that with just 20% of the world's population, the Chinese are now consuming a disproportionate share of the world's resources, about 46% of world output of steel and 77% of iron ore, and they depend on their imports of 77% of their iron ore. They are the largest consumer of lumber and forest products from Southeast Asia, New Guinea, the Congo, so forth. So this logic is just incredibly destructive because China is so huge. That's the first thing, because you have 1.4 billion people who've joined this consumer rat race like Americans. Then secondly, because of the pollution issue, because of the nature of this hybrid government, this hybrid state capitalist system that I tried to explain in my paper, the pollution is so extraordinary beyond what you find in most normal capitalisms, because the state can't control it. It can't really prevent people from polluting. China has an EPA and an FDA and all those sorts of things, but those agencies are largely, not entirely, but largely powerless to prevent pollution or to stop it once it's started. And so you have this situation where there's tremendous incentive and pressure, there's demand attraction incentives for local governments to produce and sell on the world market. And the state also supports that. But at the same time, the state and local agencies, the FDAs and EPAs and so forth, don't have the ability to control pollution so that they could do it within a framework which is, not quite so horrible as it is. But, that's why you get rivers that are every color you can imagine and cities buried in smog and just unbelievable pollution of farmland and food, such as the Chinese middle classes try as much as they can to get their food from outside of China. This is just leading to huge destruction of forest in the Amazon and so forth to grow soybeans and crops and so forth to try to feed. The Chinese are in the situation of, ironically, and this is so pathetic, so sad, they are that China has become a very large exporter of food. At the same time, its own farmlands are being increasingly ruined by industrialization, so that they're exporting polluted food and trying to import unpolluted food from the West. This is so crazy, and it's so important because this is such a huge country with such huge impact on the world. And, of course, the consequence for the health of Chinese is just appalling. The cancer epidemic, the problems of lung problems people have, the problems of food pollution, the problems and so on. It's just ghastly.
Richard, discuss the cancer villages in China today, and just how polluted is the majority of China's land with toxic chemicals, and also its waters. I was understanding that 50% of all the rivers in China are now so polluted that there's nothing for anyone to do with the water. They can't use it for irrigation, they can't use it for drinking, they can't filter it. It's that polluted. Give us your insights, please.
Well, the problem with water pollution is that there are, again, almost no controls over dumping. So you've had all these industries set up in China since the introduction of market reforms in the 1980s and 90s, and the industries in the cities were very bad, and so the government embarked on a brilliant program to kick the industries out of the cities in the 1990s and 2000s to push them out on the countryside where they wouldn't be so polluting in the cities. So what you have is you see all over China, you see these industries that just dump their pollutants in the local streams and rivers and whatnot, and are sited right next to farm fields, and then people use the irrigation water from the polluted rivers to irrigate their farms. So this has a huge impact. I mean, you have situations where industries these days, to escape the government crackdown on pollution, industries are pumping pollution directly into the soil. I mean, they've got these big pumps. They just pump it down into the ground, into the groundwater. And this is happening. I quoted these guys. This is happening on an epidemic scale all over China. This is just horrific. And they can get away with this because the government can't control them. You see, you can't. Well, you can go to the court and sue them and stop it. There's very little way they can control this stuff. So this is just a huge problem, and the consequence has been of this ruralization of industry has been the creation of the what came to be called cancer villages in China, where enormous numbers of people, high proportions, 20, 40, more percent of the local populations have cancer. And many, many people dying from this. And it's just one scholar said that there are, and she wrote this some years ago, there are at least 190 million Chinese with cancer and other diseases from this. In 2013, there was a study in Guangzhou, the capital of Guangdong Province, that found that the government FDA doesn't do many studies, and what they do, they often keep secret. But they did do this one study that reported that 40% of the rice tested at restaurants that spring in May 2013. In Guangzhou, was contaminated with cadmium, which is a highly toxic metal that can cause bone disease and associated with all kinds of diseases, including cancer. So there has not been extensive national testing over the whole country for this, and they did a big study, a 10-year study, which they then suppressed, a study of farmlands, which they suppressed for a long time because it was going to be so shocking to release it. So the consequence is that a great proportion, and nobody knows exactly how much, the government officially concedes that at least 20% of China's farmland is too polluted to farm, but there are other studies that think it's much worse. So the problem is people are stuck. They have no choice but to buy this food. This is what's offered in the market there. And as the decades go on, it gets more and more polluted. As the land is more and more polluted, and the water is more and more polluted. So what you have today is just an increasing number of middle-class Chinese who are just fleeing the country. They're just leaving. They're going to Australia, or they're going to Vancouver or Los Angeles or something, because they can, it's not just the smog in the cities, it's the water and the food and so on. I cite many reports here about the proportion of water that's undrinkable and toxic in the cities.
Richard, let's just review, because we're hitting a lot of different points here. China is a major economic power, but it's doing so in a way that virtually cannibalizes a major part of its entire society. Yes, it's growing by building products, all kinds of products. In fact, most of the products we use, some part of it comes from China. But in the process of doing this, they have to keep their population employed, and so they create these massive public work projects. Well, we should be so lucky to have public works projects in the United States, because it could put a lot of people to work, and we could fix our bridges, our dams, our reservoirs, our water pipes, and our gas pipes. Now, we need this. We need roads repaired in the United States. We have zero high-speed trains in the United States compared to Japan, China, and France and other countries, because we didn't put the money there, the public money. But in the process, they have enough of these phantom ghost cities where you go into a city and you have miles of empty apartment buildings, office towers, hospitals, schools, colleges, museums, theaters, future airports, sports facility, but all empty. These are ghost cities. And that's unfortunate. But not only there, they've actually created a ghost cities in Angola, in Africa. China has built enough new housing to rehouse the entire population, but the construction boom has become a self-sustaining perpetual engine of construction for the sake of construction, supply with no demand, end quote. So we're seeing that this makes logical sense for the construction industry, logical sense for the local politicians to have, in effect, banks that are not real banks. They borrow from the central government, but they don't have to pay them back. And so this is how the Chinese have been able to do this. Now, there are a couple other areas. I need short answers on this, if you would please, Richard. China is one of the largest creators of gold, both purchasing gold and mining gold in the world, right there with Russia. And they also want to try to float the yuan as a part of a mixed currency instead of having just the dollar as the reserve currency. And this is gaining some strength. China has also added not just the BRICS nations, BRICS standing for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, but also over 22 other countries are now joining a type of sovereign funding organization, like a bank that started with $100 billion that it could loan out, but on better conditions than the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. In effect, is competing against these, and it got a lot of countries signing up to be a part of them, including many of our allies in Europe who needed loans and better conditions than the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. So it's a player. It also has loaned over $2 to $3 trillion to the United States. And they will never see that money back, because we owe, at one point we owed $6 trillion, and we give them an IOU, a treasury note, and supposedly backed by the good faith of the United States government. But there's nothing backing it up. When we print money in our Federal Reserve, as we did $16 trillion by one estimate, $21 trillion, a more accurate estimate, to give to the 22 major corporations, including Goldman Sachs, got $884 billion, Citigroup got $2.3 trillion. So all these major corporations and some foreign banks got trillions of dollars, zero interest, laundered their dirty investments, in other words, toxic assets that went bad on them, they got to give to the Federal Reserve, that laundered them out. And so what do we have backing up all this? Nothing. Absolutely, positively, nothing. Well, why aren't we in a major inflationary cycle if we're printing money we don't have, like Zimbabwe or anyone else? because we are the United States and we don't have competition as such, because we are also the reserve currency for the moment. But our dollar is not backed by gold. So if we looked at the real value of a dollar bill, it would be worthless. But it's not. Right now it is the reserve currency. People are flooding into the dollar. It's keeping the dollar high. It's keeping equity markets, Wall Street, in the biggest bubble in its history. It's over 18,000. It should be about 5,000. So at least two-thirds of our Wall Street equity deal is a complete phantom. It's a total fraud. It's a pyramid scheme. Yet we say, look how strong we are. We're not strong. We're bankrupt. We criticize Greece at 183% debt to their gross domestic product. We criticize Italy at 100 and about 111% debt to gross domestic product. Belgium has got a debt problem of 100%. Ireland, 120%. And yet we have 500% minimum debt to our gross domestic product. So we'll never pay off our debts. We can't pay off our debts. It's impossible. We don't even have the gold that people think they own in certificates. They're going to get wiped on this. But China, on the other hand, it has loaned a lot of money to a lot of people, a lot of countries, trying to create goodwill and business. So now talk about the following. Talk about their position economically, their position of going forward, and what do you see here?
Well, I'm not an expert on Chinese banking, but for sure, far from it. But clearly, China is simply trying to establish its place in the world in the same way as, in a similar way as the U.S. has. After all, China is now the biggest economy in the world, or the next biggest, depending on how you calculate that, those GDP figures. But it's close to the biggest economy in the world, and they're increasingly integrated with the rest of the world, and increasingly so because of their need to get resources and markets for exports. So they want to bring more of the third world, especially, but also Europe, into their orbit, into their economic orbit. So they want to secure the best terms of trade and investment. They want to loan money to countries like Ecuador so they can drill for oil there. The same thing with Sudan. The same thing with they want to loan money to countries where they want their forest goods and so forth. So China has been all over the world loaning money to governments and bringing them close to China's orbit. At the same time, they want to sell Chinese commodities there, especially their light industrial production there. But not only that, I mean, China is the biggest dam builder in the world, a railway builder. They're building high-speed rails in many countries besides China. So they're making an outward push commensurate with their economic power in the same way that that the U.S. has done before. The difference is that these big industries that are going out in the world are not private capitalist industries. These are state-owned industries, overwhelmingly. They're private industries, too, but mostly the state industries are setting up in most of the third world. And those also create employment for Chinese workers. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese workers work overseas on Chinese construction projects, building railways and infrastructure in Africa and Asia and Latin America and so forth. So the main thing, I think, is that they're simply attempting to recreate the network of imperial connections, power that the United States has had before. And so that's why they want to make the yuan an international currency, and they want to create a multilateral bank that the Chinese dominate, and like the IMF and the World Bank. And so they want to replicate those only under Chinese control, because that gives them much better access and control over markets and so forth.
Okay, and by the way, that is the Asia Infrastructure Development Bank.
Yeah.
Which is competing with the International Monetary Funds, and simply because Russia, China, and other countries that have joined are fed up with the Western banking model and its structural adjustments. Now, just a final, we're coming up to the end of our program. And I'd like to turn to the U.S.-China relations because in the Pentagon's quest to start a Cold War 2.0, primarily targeted against Russia, the U.S. has been stepping up aggressive, militant posturing against China as well. And our moronic politicians are eager to go along with this. Chris Christie in June called for war against China. George Soros has publicly stated his deep concerns about U.S. starting a World War III with China. And China itself has warned of this inevitable catastrophe if the U.S. doesn't cease to interfere in its affairs and internal military construction, particularly in the South China Sea, where China is building artificial islands. China has reason to believe that the U.S. is planning a conflict. We're doing it against Russia and anybody else who doesn't go along with the Washington consensus. So China simply is saying that they need to prepare themselves for American aggression. And this was outlined by the Center for Chinese Strategic Studies at the Hudson Institute not very long ago. But what is the likelihood of this if the U.S. is far, far more militarily superior to China? And why would China or even Russia, for that matter, want to jeopardize all that is achieved? I don't see by any measure a war with China or Russia for two reasons. A, because we couldn't, with all of our military power and trillions of dollars and thousands of lost lives and all of our best generals, we couldn't defeat the Taliban on camels, all right, in Afghanistan, nor in Iraq. We are a mess. We have lost every conflict, and we have created massive and perpetual suffering because of it. We have created genocide. In Vietnam, when you caused the death of 3.2 million innocent civilians, you leave a legacy of toxic Agent Orange, which caused birth defects and mines that you didn't take away after the conflict, and so kids blow their legs off. Now imagine China with the largest army in the world, and imagine Russia and their partners, all right? And then look at the cities in Russia and the modernization over the last 15 years. And look at China and the modernization, and look at the capital there. Look at the business interest. The Chinese are not going to jeopardize being bombed into the Stone Age. The Russians are neither going to do that. And the United States would have no chance in hell unless it nuked, and I wouldn't put that past anyone in power because we have sociopaths, and we all know that, in positions from the White House and the entire septic system called Washington, D.C. is just one giant sociopathic center. So those people might want to risk a war, but no reasonable, sane person would ever think of it. So why the need for the posturing and the placing of NATO and the support of the coup to put fascists and Nazi sympathizers in power in Kiev, and then to get our military out there and as if we're going to do something? This is all just vile and stupid, in my opinion. Your thoughts?
Well, I completely agree with you, Gary. China is not aiming to go to war against anybody. This military posturing is, to a certain extent, a felt need to push back. After all, the Chinese are not... How many Chinese battleships are off the coast of California? How many Chinese missiles are positioned nearby on ships, on submarines, and so forth. So, you know, the Americans look at the world in an upside-down way. You know, the Chinese are looking at American planes that spy on them and fly around there, and ships off their coast, and defending Taiwan, and so on and so forth, not to mention invading Vietnam and China at the end of World War II. So the Chinese have good reason to be wary and resistant of American domination of East Asia militarily. So they're pushing back against that. But to a large extent, it's rhetorical, verbal, because they don't have the technology to do this. One of the problems with the Chinese hybrid system is that they can't invent much. You know, it's a quasi-totalitarian economy. And there's, you know, people can't have access to the Internet, to Google, and they can't get their email accounts, and can't can't read Western periodicals and scientific literature and so forth, how are they going to develop a military that can compete with the United States? It's just never going to happen. So this is a big problem. This is mostly for show, and also because, you know, these bodies, the military bureaucracy, the military has a vested interest in, like militaries everywhere, you know, they want to do something. They want appropriations, so they want guns and ships and planes and so forth, so they have to justify their interest. In China, what you have is the military, you have what they call in China the army that makes money, because China's military... We didn't talk about corruption, which is a really interesting aspect of China's society and economy, in that the military, I'll just say, is so corrupt from top to bottom. Offices are bought. Generalships are bought and sold in the Chinese army. The Chinese military is so corrupt, it feels, and you can read, there are plenty of articles in the press and documents and so forth, that the Chinese are very concerned that their military couldn't fight any kind of war because it is so besotted with corruption. The army owns everything from arms, illegal arms sales around the world, to hotels and resorts and all kinds of manufacturing. The officer class in China is one of the most corrupt aspects of the entire Communist Party bureaucracy. So they're not interested in going to war. They're interested in making money.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us today, Dr. Richard Smith. And Dr. Smith's latest book is Green Capitalism, The God That Failed. I'm Gary Noll. You've been listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much, and have a nice day.
Thanks, Gary.